seated. So I'll call our third case for the day, Emers Camper Corral versus Western Heritage. Counselor, are you prepared to begin?
Yes, Your Honor.
Please do.
Members of the court, counsel, my name is Stephen Miller. I represent the plaintiff appellant in this case, Emers Camper Corral. Emers Camper Corral is a business located in Siren, Wisconsin, that sells new and used RV campers, trailers. The business is owned and run by Rhonda Emmer and her husband. From October 2007 until September of 2012, Emmer had a hail insurance policy that covered her inventory with a deductible of $500 per unit. She obtained these policies through her agent, Michael Alderman, who is the defendant in this case. Emmer had a hailstorm damage in 2011 and again in 2012. After paying both claims, her insurer gave a notice of non-renewal. She then asked Alderman to find other coverage for the next policy period, starting in late 2012. Alderman found coverage with Heritage Insurance Company, but the deductible was $5,000 per unit. Emmer accepted this policy, but told Alderman she wanted a lower deductible. The following August, 2013, Alderman told Emmer that Western Heritage would renew the next policy starting on October 1st, 2013, with a $1,000 per unit deductible and a $5,000 cap.
And could she have gotten a policy with those terms of coverage?
Could she have gotten that $1,000 deductible at that time?
Yeah, well, in the policy period at issue here, could she have gotten a policy with $1,000 per unit deductible?
Well, that's the question, and whether or not that's the standard. And I would argue that, we need to address the standard. There's no evidence in particular. She did not present evidence that she could get a $1,000 policy.
But she did present evidence that Erie Insurance would have written one for the following year with a $1,000 deductible.
That's correct.
Correct?
Right. The case really boils down to, there's really two avenues to show causal damages in this case. One is to show the opportunity to get another policy, had she known what the deductible was, or the choice to not engage in the uninsured activity or mitigate damages. Those are really the two avenues I see of showing causal damages in this case.
So there wasn't any evidence of mitigation of damages. There could have been. I know in your brief you talked about ways that they could have mitigated, maybe by covering the campers, maybe by taking on less inventory. But there's nothing in the record that was done, correct?
There's no evidence in the record that's what she would have done had she had that opportunity. That's correct.
Okay.
My argument in terms of that issue, however, is that we're dealing with a directed verdict. And the directed verdict looks at the record as a whole. And the record as a whole, whether or not there are reasonable inferences that can be made by the jury. And so my argument there is that a jury acting reasonably could infer that mitigation was possible.
How? What would they use to do that?
Well, we have mobile RV units. I think it's from the record itself. It's a common sense inference. They can be moved. They can.
I don't
be put
think there's anything common sense about that. I couldn't figure out what the physical layout was as I was reading the briefs in this case. It could be this is just on a very large plot of land, and there was nowhere to go with the campers.
Well, certainly that's one inference that could be drawn.
Okay. If you drew a different inference, wouldn't that just be speculation?
Well, I think any inference is speculation in terms of what she might have been able to do or what she would have done. I mean, obviously, if she would have testified that, you know, I could have done this, I could have done that. I mean, let's face it, we're dealing with self-serving, speculative testimony.
Right. But she could have testified to that, and she could have explained, here's what I would have done. I've got this friend that's got this huge warehouse. I could have gone and stuck him in there. I've got this portable covering that I could have erected over the campus. She could have testified all manner of ways that she could have taken steps to mitigate the possibility of damage, but she didn't provide any testimony like that, correct?
That's correct.
Okay. So let's focus then on whether there are damages resulting from her inability, from the fact that she did not have the insurance policy that she thought she had.
Justice Kelly, could I add a question onto your first line of questions before you ask that one?
Yep.
And I wanted to know about the answers. The other one that is kind of in line with what Justice Kelly was asking, if she had been told, and I know there's a dispute of fact of whether she was told or not, if she had been told that the Second Western policy had a $5,000 deductible, she could have looked for other insurance, but she had no reason to look, right?
She had no reason to look.
Okay, you know, all right.
And so we're dealing strictly with a causality question, and the standard of causality,
right,
which is substantial factor.
But didn't her expert testify that she would not have been able to obtain insurance with a $1,000 per unit deductible because of the two claims?
Well, it was a deposition that was put into the record, and he said it was unlikely. However, he didn't rule it out. I mean, he did make testimony that, you know, basically you work with the underwriter. All underwriters are different. Didn't rule it out. You know, and I would add here, too, you know, we're not dealing
Before you go there, I mean, whether he ruled it out or not, I don't think this is the question. Emers has the obligation to satisfy the burden of proof, right? And this is a negligence case. So that's duty, breach, causation, and damage. And all of those belong to Emers. Emers has to prove that, right?
Correct. So what does she have to prove? What's the burden of production here? Does she have to show that she could have gotten a better policy during that policy period? Or does she have to show general commercial availability?
Okay. So why would it be general commercial availability? And the reason, and I understand that's your position. And the reason I ask is this. As we all know, insurance companies write policies in part based on claims. And so I'm not sure why general availability is relevant to whether Emers could have gotten insured under the terms that she...
It's really a question of how do we allocate the burden of production. And I think the Bailey case is probably the most thoughtful case and the most logical case, and I think the fairest case.
Right. The shifting burden to the defendant.
The burden starts with a burden of production by the plaintiff and then a response burden by the defendant, and then it goes to the jury as a question of fact.
So let me ask you a little bit about that shifting burden. So if the burden is only on the plaintiff to show general commercial availability, and then the burden shifts to the defendant to prove that the plaintiff could not have been insured under those terms, isn't the defendant in the position then of having to prove a negative? And wouldn't that require the defendant to query every single insurance company in the world to find out whether they would insure Emers under the terms that she wanted?
I'm not sure it's any different. If the plaintiff had to prove that she could get an insurance policy retroactively, often years later,
right?
You know, is that easier?
Well, it's her claim, right? She's coming to court and saying, "I could have been insured under better terms." Okay, put your money where your mouth is. If you think that's true, show why you think that's true.
Right. Well, if that is the standard, then you're correct. And my argument is that the substantial factor test doesn't require that. You know, if we look at how substantial factor is treated in Wisconsin law, it's not the only cause, it's not the main cause, it's not the cause, it's a cause. And my argument is that...
But we don't know if it's a cause unless we know whether that would have been available two EMERs.
Well, it is a cause in the sense that commercial availability means that kind of insurance is available.
To other people?
Possibly.
Okay, and that's the key here. So why should she be relieved of proving that's available to her? She's the one claiming damages.
I think it's because it becomes a very difficult burden, for one thing. And I think that, if you look at how the cases have handled it, I think
Before you go there, is there any other reason than difficulty?
I think no.
Okay. So how do we score the difficulty between the plaintiff and the because the plaintiff only has to find one insurance company that would have insured her under those terms, whereas the defendant has to prove that no insurance company in the world would insure her under those terms. Now, one seems to be easier than the other, doesn't it?
Well, I'm not sure that's – I think you're creating a false dilemma there. I mean, because we're dealing with probabilities. I mean, that really in some ways defines the question. What's the level of certainty we're going to require on proving damages? You know, and what is the level of certainty in terms of a question of fact that's being put to the jury, a substantial factor?
Okay, then you tell me what it is. So if we're dealing with the Bailey shifting of the burden, what standard does the defendant have to meet in establishing the plaintiff could not have been insured under the terms that she wanted?
Well, it's substantial factor. That is, and the problem is what does that mean in this context?
Substantial factor doesn't have anything to do with proving a negative. How do you, at what point would we say the defendant has done his job of establishing the plaintiff could not have been insured under the terms she wanted?
Well, I mean, I think if you have a situation where, obviously it's going to be probably from expert testimony, could be from insurance agents that, these people are uninsurable.
Okay, so we do have testimony from Robert Sutton, that was EMER's own insurance expert, correct?
Yes.
Okay. And Mr. Sutton says, well, this is the question that was asked of him. Okay, so during the September 13 to September 14 policy, now that you've been provided with the amount of the two previous claims, do you think it's possible to get a policy with $1,000, $5,000 aggregate deductible for wind and hail? Answer, no. Why isn't that sufficient to end the case?
Well, I mean, he does qualify that testimony, and basically says underwriters are going to look at things differently. I mean, you're dealing with a risk here that's not of any fault of my client. I mean, frankly, I don't even understand the underwriting theory here. I mean, we're talking about a weather event that my client doesn't control and how her claims somehow are going to predict what the next 12 months are going to bring. We're the guy down the road, maybe didn't have a claim, and it's going to be treated differently. To say that you can't say that no underwriter would look at it.
Okay.
She never looked. I mean, that's the problem. She never actually tried to. She didn't know it was a requirement, frankly.
I just want to get all that. And I'm just trying to figure out what the standard looks like that you want us to apply. So even with EMER's own expert saying that she couldn't have gotten this policy, that you say that's not enough to end the case. So with that kind of testimony, what more is the defendant supposed to prove than what Sutton himself said?
Yeah, my argument is it doesn't end the case because it goes to the jury. He got his evidence in. She put her evidence in. The jury may very well agree with you.
Yeah, I know. But I'm looking for standards here. So what is the defendant supposed to bring to the table more than what Mr. Sutton said? Mr. Sutton said she couldn't have gotten this policy. But you think that's not enough for the defense to prevail in this case. So what would the defendant have to establish so that this would be properly the subject of a directed verdict motion?
Yeah, my argument is once commercial availability is proven, the burden of production is met. Goes to the jury.
So it always goes to a jury?
The burden of production is met. It goes to the jury. If the burden of production is general commercial availability, that's what Bailey holds. That's what I would argue.
Counsel, I want to talk a little bit about our standard of review, assuming this is a directed verdict. And you use that term as well. I know there's some dispute over what's what here, but assume for the moment on this causation question that it was a directed verdict. You know, we have this standard of whether it's clearly wrong. And even though there's sort of the general rule that a directed verdict should only be granted if you know, there's no credible evidence to sustain a finding, but we also say the circuit courts are better positioned to decide the weight and relevance of the testimony, and that we're supposed to give substantial deference to their better ability to assess the evidence. So taking that standard of review into account here, can you walk through the best evidence that you have that shows that this should be reversed, understanding that maybe there's a plausible inference that could be drawn here or there, maybe, but you have a trial court that heard everything and said, listen, there's no way jury could come to the opposite conclusion.
I mean, part of the problem here is the lack of advance notice of standards. And I think that, I'm not trying to use that as an excuse, but, the evidence is the argument's primarily based on, and my argument is that commercial availability meets the burden of production. And so it doesn't matter after that. It's then the defendant's opportunity to counter evidence, and then it gets thrown into the pot, so to speak, and the jury decides. And so that's really my argument. Now, you want me to take it a step further and say, what's the reasonable? Is there a reasonable inference here? The defendant's experts didn't rule out the possibility of a $1,000 deductible here if high enough premiums were paid. Now, they claim, we don't know what the premium would be. It would probably be astronomical, but we don't know. But they didn't rule that out. And like I said, we got a situation here which is unusual to me in terms of the insurance context, where we're dealing with really, to me, a lack of logic in terms of the underwriting. So would it all insurance companies, if indeed she had the opportunity to look for insurance, and would all insurance companies reject her on a $1,000 deductible? I think there's a possibility here. I mean, it's certainly more than a possibility, and I think that commercial availability is certainly, if the standard is that she has to prove she could have gotten another policy during the same policy period that's better than the one she got, then I would agree that claim fails.
Counsel, perhaps I'm missing something. I'm looking at the transcript of the expert, and it is page 137 of the transcript. And the question is, okay, so during the September 30th, 2013, to September 30th, 2014 policy, now that you've been provided with the amount of the two previous claims, do you think it's possible to get a policy with a $1,000, $5,000 aggregate deductible for wind and hail? Answer, no. So you have several times now during argument suggested that the expert has said it's possible. So maybe there's another part of the transcript that I'm missing that you could point me to.
I do make reference to it in my brief, and I'd be happy to point that out.
You can maybe find it during opposing counsel's argument and then talk about it in rebuttal.
Sure. Sure. I would also add that the expert that was hired to address the negligence standard, and this was almost kind of the deposition was, an adverse question from opposing counsel, and I don't know if I can qualify it that way, but the point is that there is a point in the transcript later where there was kind of a follow-up to that question, and there is some question about, with underwriters you never know, and I can't rule it out. But, I think the point is that, it's a jury question. I mean, and that's really what my position is what is the burden of production here, and, both for the plaintiff and for the defendant. Obviously, if the rule had been known before the case was brought, it would have been tried differently. I, as appellate counsel, I always look at these cases, and I wish I could gone back in time and, you know, I mean, just the, you know, obviously the claims and the, that were made in the complaint, I have some issues with that.
Are you depending upon the adoption of some sort of burden shifting scenario? Is that, does your argument require that?
I believe it probably does. I think there is some burden shifting here. You know, if again, if the issue is, if you know, if my client's burden of production is proving that she could have gotten a policy during the same policy period on better terms, then yeah, the claim fails.
I would think, and maybe I'm off on this, but your argument might be more in the nature of without a burden shifting, that you might say something along the lines of, as long as I show somebody could get this policy, that you know, it at least shows the plausibility that I've been damaged, and the jury should hear that claim, and it may or may not, you know, require any sort of counterproof. It may not be very good evidence of damages, but what you're saying is sort of it meets a threshold requirement. I guess I'm trying to figure out why you necessarily need the burden shifting as part of your argument. I didn't pick that up in your brief as a prerequisite to you.
It's really not. I mean, you could claim it's really not a burden shifting. It's about plaintiff meeting her burden of production. And then once that happens, and that's a threshold determination. That's a burden of production, commercial availability, and then the defendant's open to present contrary evidence. Whether that's a there's really no burden there. You know, it's just that at that point it goes to the jury.
So
that's really not a burden shifting, I suppose.
Counsel, are there other circumstances in which we allow a question to go to the jury when the plaintiff has not shown that the thing that she wanted would be available to her but would be available to others?
I mean, the vast majority of cases dealing with this are injuries. You know,
are
injuries or medical, I don't know that there's another example in Wisconsin. And, you know, like I said, in my opinion, the majority of cases that have dealt with this in other states use commercial availability as the threshold for burden of production. I can't answer that, no. I mean, in the case of injuries, obviously, you know, there's case law, multiple cases in this state that have made it clear that substantial factor is a factor. It's a causal factor. It's a factor of that's operating, the negligence of the defendant is operating at the time of the injury, at the time of the damages. It doesn't have to be the immediate cause, the primary cause. It needs to be a cause. And, you know, my argument would be is that that's more compatible with commercial availability because obviously that's necessary. The agents misrepresenting what the policy deductible is, the availability, the commercial availability of that policy is, and as a burden of production, is sufficient to show substantial cause. I think if we look at how that concept's been applied in other contexts.
I've been trying to figure out in reviewing this case the necessity of sort of blanket rules, and you have sort of dueling rules that are being proposed, and you know, seeing this in some of the cases. But I'm curious whether you're open to the idea that could it be if this was a claim from 5 or 6 years ago where you don't have any sort of contemporaneous evidence that the proof, I mean, your argument that it was difficult to show that I definitely could have gotten this policy, that maybe that this type of policy would be available, could be sufficient in some circumstances, but maybe not others. I'm curious why we need a sort of threshold rule requirement and why it might not be a more narrow, fact-dependent kind of case dealing with what you need to do to prove your damages in a given case.
Well, I think the rule only applies in terms of the directed verdict. You know, that's the question here is the jury decides that issue. You know, that's the question. Do we take it away from the jury? And so the rule is simply what does the plaintiff have to do to get it to a jury? That's really what we're talking about and prevents a court from doing a directed verdict. you know, it's not about ultimately proving the claim because the jury has to make that determination.
Are you limiting your argument to cases where there is an ability to change behavior versus help, let's say, when we deal with insurance in the health context where you can't necessarily change your behavior, you either qualify for the policy or you don't qualify for the policy?
No, I'm not limiting it to that. I think Bailey is clear in terms of the burden of production. If there's commercial availability, it goes to the jury.
No matter what. Okay.
And then the other question is, okay, can you react? You know, what can you do to minimize your damages? You know, can you make a choice to minimize your damages?
Well, isn't that a way of showing the causation besides getting potentially the other policy? The other thing you could have done would have been to give evidence of behavior changing.
That's correct. And you know, but I'm dealing with this record. You know,
right.
So what, you know, okay.
Right. Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court and counsel, my name is Rolf Sonneson. With me is my colleague Beth LeCan. We represent Michael Alderman and Jensen Sundquist Agency, which are the respondents in this appeal. The standard of review, we've touched on that. It's a directed verdict. And when the circuit court renders a directed verdict, the standard on appellate review is whether or not the circuit court was clearly wrong. And our position is that the evidence it justifies the granting of the directed verdict, that there is no evidence that Mike Alderman caused Emmer's Campers Corral any damage.
How about the quote that was given from
Erie,
right, and it was given and received, actually, for this particular facility.
Yes.
The day of the last hailstorm, or at least
yes.
The last one that's in the record. Why isn't that sufficient for a jury to conclude that on that day she could get that? Why isn't it sufficient for the jury to infer she could have gotten the same thing a year earlier if she had known about the high deductible that had the second West, that was in the second Western?
Well, the circuit court addressed that and said it's on page 51 of volume 2. That policy period commencing September 30, 2014, that would be the third policy. That would be.
That's right. It's 1 year after the loss.
That would be. That's a different policy period.
Well, it is a different policy period. But what I'm asking you is, why couldn't the jury infer from argument that she didn't know she had to get one for the second Western policy because she thought she had a $1,000 deductible, and she could get one because 1 year, less than 1 year later, she got one. So why can't the jury infer she could have gotten it the year before?
Because that would be an unreasonable, unspeculative inference backward as to what would be available.
Well, it would all be speculation, Counselor. If she's going to get somebody to testify, she could have gotten something in the year that's already passed. That's backwards, too.
Well, but the expert that Emmer Camper Corral did retain, Mr. Sutton, said it's not it would not have been possible for Emmer's Campers Corral to obtain a $1,000
deductible.
I think he
said more than that. I think he said that it depends on relationships and it depends on how much business you do with different companies. And underwriters' rights depend on relationships. That was
yes.
The last thing that he said in the part of his deposition that was read, Counselor.
Yes, he did. He was explaining the general context of an insurance agent obtaining insurance for the insurance customer. But he says quite definitively in answer to the question, is it possible for this policy period to obtain a $1,000 deductible? And Mr. Sutton said with an unqualified answer, no.
I don't agree with you that it was unqualified, but you and I can disagree about what the transcript actually shows. I'm more interested in why the jury couldn't be entitled to consider the Erie policy that she testified to in her direct examination.
Well, because that was for the next policy period. If we put this
into
context.
I know it was for the next policy period, Counselor. I'm just asking you, why couldn't the jury infer, if she could get it, for the period that was to start at the end of September, and I think she got the quote September the 3rd, the policy ended the 29th, why was the jury not free to determine that she could also have gotten one earlier?
I'll put some context into that. I think it'll be helpful.
Good.
Can I just add to that a little bit?
Yeah.
Because on the front end of that, at least at page 19 of the blue brief, it says that Emmer testified she had a policy from 2007 to 2012 with a $500 deductible. And then Alderman testified that on June 18, 2014, he received an offer to insure her with a $1,000 deductible.
Right.
So with all those things coupled together, why wouldn't that be enough to create an issue of fact in that regard?
Well, the context that I'd like to put before the court is it is undisputed that Ms. Emmer and Mr. Alderman agree that after the September 2011 claim of about $100,000 and the 2012 Hale claim of about over $100,000, Mr. Alderman not be able to get Hale coverage in the what they call the standard market, so we'd have to go to the excess and surplus lines. And he was able to get a quote with Western Heritage, $5,000 deductible per camper, and explained, and she agreed in her testimony, Ms. Emmer's testimony, that it was going to be a two-year time frame before they could probably try and get back into the standard market. And then for that, so Western Heritage is in place September 30 of 2012 to September 30 of 2013, September 30 of 2014. In other words, Western Heritage policy number one, Western Heritage policy number two. And in August, Alderman was able to find a new company in the standard market with Erie. And he was able to get a quote with a $1,000 deductible, but that was for September 30, 2014.
So that's outside the two-year period.
That's outside the two-year period, and the circuit court recognized, and this is on page 51, volume 2, the fact of the matter is she could obtain a quote for $1,000 with a $15,000 per occurrence in 2015 or 2016, is significantly different in all aspects to what she could have, whether or not she had or she believed she had it in the 2013-2014 year. Too many factors could have changed at that time. And so, again, the claims history is critical here in terms of the underwriting. And all of the evidence indicates that Emmer's Campers Corral was unable to be in the standard market and to get a $1,000 deductible. So to go back and say, well, we could get it with Erie for September 30, 2014 onward with a $1,000 deductible in the standard market, to go backwards in times is, as the circuit court recognized, an unjustified, speculative inference.
Was Erie in the standard market?
Yes.
Okay.
And that's so a standard, yes.
That answers my question.
Okay. I was just going to harken back a bit to what Justice Hagedorn was talking about, because that's kind of been in the back of my mind as well. Why do we need a hard and fast majority rule in all of these kinds of cases? Doesn't the rule change a little bit depending on what kind of claim is made? For example, the snowmobile case, the Minnesota case.
Runyon?
Mm-hmm. When, the testimony was, I asked if they're insured, and if I knew they weren't insured, I would have never let them ride those snowmobiles.
Right.
Right? And if her claim here was, I thought I had this kind of insurance, I thought I had it for these many vehicles, and if I would have known I had it for fewer, or if I would have known that I had this, then I would have constructed some sort of tarp, or I would have held them in a different premises, or I would have kept them in a warehouse. I don't want to get into too many hypotheticals, but it strikes me that if that kind of claim is made, like in the snowmobile case, then perhaps the test would be different.
Oh, I think it is. I think it is different because, but let's look at the
and health insurance cases where you're denied health insurance. That seems like a different scenario to me than, for example, this.
No, I agree that those there is a difference in that relation because you either got Mellon, Wallace. There's a pre-existing heart condition, and that's not going to change. But the circumstantial evidence here, I think, is very, very strong and overwhelming. Because it is undisputed that when Mr. Alderman first had to go to Rhonda Emmer with the Western Heritage policy and the $5,000 deductible to start September 30, 2012 to September 30, 2000, that's the first Western Heritage policy. Ms. Emmer's Campers Corral had to have that insurance, satisfy the bank, and conducted the business just as Emmer's Campers Corral had done previously. Then the policy renews for the second Western Heritage policy, and that's the policy period in question in which the September 3, 2014 loss occurs. But here's what is perhaps the nail in the coffin for Emmer's Campers Corral in this regard. Even after Ms. Emmer she testified that she was surprised and disappointed that she had a $5,000 deductible for the September 3, 2014 loss. The Western Heritage policy was still available to renew with a $5,000 deductible, and Emmer's Campers Corral elected to get that same Western Heritage policy with the same $5,000 deductible, and it conducted business the same way that next year.
But so that's a question of fact.
Right.
Your client says, yes, that's what I told her, and that's what she agreed to. She says, no. He called me up and said, I've got good news, and she went, okay? But the good news was not a reduction of deductible, which she said in her testimony she thought was included.
Your Honor, that is the essence of the dispute about whether or not there was negligence or negligent misrepresentation. I do not dispute or argue. I'm not arguing that there's not a question of fact about that. What I assert is that there is no evidence of that if that is proven, that there's a cause of damage to Emmer's Campers Corral.
Right, I understand that. And you and I disagree a little bit because this hasn't gone to the jury yet. If
right.
it had gone to the jury and the jury had been presented and let to decide whether they could infer from the Erie policy that Erie, if asked, would have written a policy earlier, fine, fine. But that's, when a directed verdict is made in Wisconsin, the judge takes it under advisement, keeps it there till the jury's verdict comes back, and if the judge thinks the jury's gotten off the track, there's a JNOV. Usually a judge doesn't take it from the jury. You hadn't even presented much
of
your case at all.
That is something that the circuit court could have done, but I think that the fact that the evidence was so overwhelming.
Well, if you eliminate Erie, it might be overwhelming.
Well,
but
again,
I don't think it is otherwise.
There is no evidence that the Erie policy could have been procured for the policy period in question.
But can't they infer that it came down? Well, the policy period, it wasn't something that was gotten together 5 years later. It was gotten together and a quote was made and received during the second policy period for
yes.
Western. Okay, so you think they can't infer from that yes, they could have gotten one earlier if he
Correct.
Tried.
Correct.
Okay, I understand that's your position.
Correct.
So what exactly is the causation question?
Right.
What's the evidence?
Whether or not the alleged negligence or whether or not the alleged negligent misrepresentation of the insurance agent, Mr. Alderman, is a cause of damage to Emmer's Campers Corral.
Do you agree that cause could have been shown by some kind of testimony that Emmers would have done something differently had
yes.
they known.
Yes.
Okay, but your argument is that they didn't do that here. They
yes.
didn't put that forward. Does it matter that no one knew, that they didn't know they had to do it? If they didn't know what the standard was, how would they know to put it
forward? Well, we go back, I think we go back to the circumstantial evidence. Emmers Campers Corral conducted its business just as it always had when it had the first Western Heritage policy with a $5,000 deductible. And it conducted its business just as it had after the, when it was in the third policy period with Western Heritage. And indeed, Emmers Campers Corral had to have a policy in place to satisfy its bank.
Would it have been enough for them to say, though, had I known that I had to pay, that I had this $5,000 deductible, that I would have put a tarp over my...
I think that would have been some evidence of detrimental reliance permitting it to get to the jury.
But none of that went forward, and so you're saying
correct.
Based on that, there was no causation shown that way.
Correct.
Okay.
So I took from your briefs, and this is along my questions earlier, Justice Siegler picked up on, this idea that we have these competing general rules here that we need to apply in these types of situations. And in fact, the Court of Appeals opinion reads an awful lot like a pretty blanket rule that applies to these types of cases. And now what I'm hearing you say is, well, no, it depends on the facts that are actually pled. So if there was a claim, if this claim had been brought and tried, where the damages included maybe some element of mitigation, that might have been enough in this situation. That the rule that you need to show you could have obtained the policy isn't the only possible, you know, might not apply in this situation when there might be other measures of damages. And then I have a follow-up question, but
I think that sure, if the record were different.
And I understand the factual argument that there's not, you know, there weren't facts. I understand your argument. There were not facts to prove that. But I'm actually just, before we get to that point, and I know your client cares about that, obviously, from an outcome, but I'm also interested in making sure that we write a decision that's going to announce a careful rule to be applied going forward. And I was concerned reading the Court of Appeals opinion that we had something that seemed to, in a blanket way, apply to all these types of insurance cases. And I'm not sure if that's quite accurate.
Your Honor, are you referring to the burden of proof issue?
This, whether you need to prove that you could have obtained this exact policy in order to succeed on this type of claim. And if your argument is, well, no, if they had presented evidence on mitigation, then it could have gone to the jury, that would seem to throw that blanket rule out, that threshold rule, to remove that as an impediment from the jury hearing that question.
Well, I mean, pardon me.
Yeah, that's what I was getting at, too, and also the causation question. The causation question is different if it's that kind of question. Gosh, I would have put up the tarps, and this failure caused this kind of damage instead of this failure caused that. I didn't need you to recite what the causation question generally looks like. But what's the difference when it's the claim of I have to initially prove I could get this policy versus when the claim is something like I would have taken different action had I known I had that kind of policy.
Right.
That's a difference in the causation.
Well,
they're different.
Right. It goes to detrimental reliance. And if there is some evidence of detrimental reliance in a negligent misrepresentation cause of action that is credible, reliable evidence of detrimental reliance, then yes, I think that the prima facie case, including causation, is established.
Isn't it enough just to show that she would have looked for another policy if she had known? And she had no way to show that because she thought she had it.
Well, and then we go back to there was no policy of insurance available to Emmers Campers Corral with a $1,000 deductible.
That's the claim that he negligently got her the wrong policy. I was looking at what Justice Ziegler was asking, and there's a negligent misrepresentation here, and you were talking about justifiable reliance, and my question goes to, well, wouldn't she have just gotten other insurance? Her testimony was she relied on the fact that she thought she had a $1,000 deductible. And if you stop right there, knowing that your client says, I never told her that, but if you stop right there, why isn't that enough to show justifiable reliance? She didn't get another policy because she thought she had one.
Well, there's no evidence that she would have looked for another policy.
Well, why would but she? We're,
well, oh, I understand that, but we're back to the what Mr. Miller says is the unavailability in a general way, and what my argument is for an individual insured, it simply because a $1,000 deductible is commercially or generally available in the insurance marketplace, it doesn't really have meaning until we apply the individual insured to...
I understand that argument for the claim that he got her the wrong policy, okay? And then she'd, on your side of the street, would have to show that he could have gotten her what she asked for. But I'm looking more at the justifiable reliance in misrepresentation. And if the jury were to believe her that he told her she had a $1,000 policy...
Mm-hmm.
Well, why would she be going around looking for something else? Because she already had what she thought she needed.
I agree.
Well,
but
then what's
she,
missing on the proof
Because
of
what's
that
missing
claim?
Is that even if she had known that and looked, she couldn't, Emmer's Campers Corral could not have obtained it. And well, that's the evidence in the trial court record.
Counsel, what if the policy...
And they couldn't have obtained it because of the history of claims for that policy.
That's period. Correct. The claims history is analogous to the pre-existing heart condition that we have in the Mellon case and the Wallace case.
Pre-existing heart condition is the guy could never get insured. I don't think the medical cases work here at all. I mean, I understand that's what appeals thought, but that's because they relied on a Minnesota case and they also relied on Western from Wisconsin. Both of those are medical cases. If someone's got a leaking heart, you're stuck with that. That's not going to change. This is much different.
But an insured business is stuck with its claims history.
Yeah, but if it's going to hail this year or not, it's a lot different from whether a guy's heart is going to heal itself when he's got overwhelming heart disease.
Whether or not Mr. Miller agrees with the logic of life insurance underwriting, that is the fact that the underwriters view claims history and take that into account.
Counsel, what if there had been evidence presented at trial? And again, I understand that the facts are what was presented. But what if there had been evidence presented that a policy with a $50,000 aggregate maximum would have been obtainable? Should that go to the jury or not?
It depends upon the testimony of Rhonda Emmer and whether or not she would have purchased that. But my answer is, again, speaking out of context, it probably is admissible.
Admissible, yes, but...
Oh, you mean...
Would it go to the jury, right? In other words, this is an example of, I can't get the same policy, but what if I could have shown I could have gotten a better policy than the one I actually had?
Oh, I see.
And instead of $125,000, $120,000 in damages, I only would have been out $50,000.
Yeah. Well, I think that goes to the mitigation, and yes, I think that it would then go to the jury.
Okay. So... It's not necessarily then a blanket rule that you always need to prove you could have obtained the same policy. But is your argument then, because that was the claim in this case, that was the only attempted damages proven in this case, the facts didn't measure up to that, there was no facts showing mitigation, and a jury could not have inferred otherwise, or at least the trial court wasn't clearly wrong in saying so, therefore, your client would win. But we don't necessarily need to announce a blanket rule that says every time you have this type of case, you always need to show you could have gotten that same policy. Is that fair?
I think that's a succinct statement.
So stated differently, assuming duty and breach, when you get to cause and harm, the question that's relevant is whether she could have bought this policy or a more favorable policy.
Or a more favorable policy, yes.
Or and mitigated her damages.
To mitigate damages, yes.
Some way of doing that. Okay.
Yes, I think that's fair. I think that would be. I think that that's a fair statement of a rule.
Counsel, you're opposing counsel, and maybe you were listening attentively. started out, or maybe were nervous and preoccupied, wondering what questions we would ask, started out saying that there are two avenues. And as I understood it, the first dealt with this whole general availability issue, and the second dealt with mitigation, and that is, I have in my notes, there's no evidence and record what she would have done, but his argument is the jury could have inferred something. And so I hear my colleagues talking about just the first avenue, but the second avenue in terms of some kind of you could call it, I guess, reliance, justifiable or unjustifiable reliance, is always a second avenue in these types of cases, as I shouldn't say always.
Well, but is well in a negligent misrepresentation case, that's part of the prima facie case, detrimental reliance, justifiable reliance, yes.
That's it.
Okay.
That's it. I mean, so it's not, I mean, I don't share the concern about, a hard and fast rule, because number one, there are more than one avenues to get relief here. And secondly, hard and fast rules is what we do.
To the extent you can, yes.
You know, I mean, it's hard and fast until it isn't. But by that I mean, here's a legal question of what is necessary to show causation in this type of a case.
Yes.
And is general availability sufficient to send it to the jury? Or do you need, in addition to general availability, eligibility in order to prove causation?
Yes. Yeah, and we broke it down into two parts. And that simply to say it's generally available or commercially available as a general rule isn't enough because, as the Mellon case points out, the Wallace case points out, and the appellant argues, well, those are highly individualized cases. But that's our point. Emmer's Camper's Corral is a highly individualized insured because of the two big hail damage claims in 2011 and 2012, which rendered Emmer's Camper's Corral unable to get that type of, I guess we'd call favorable or desirable insurance in the 2013 to 14 and that time frame, right? And insurance is only meaningful when you have a willing prospective insured and a willing insurer to enter into an insurance contract.
Does the record reflect why Erie pulled its quote?
Yes, because Mr. Alderman as an agent is obligated to notify Erie of an underwriting concern, and the September 3, 2014 hail damage, he was obligated to notify Erie, and then Erie decided to pull its quote.
Did Erie pull the quote?
Ethically obligated to do that.
The quote was to stand for 60 days, correct?
The Erie quote?
Yeah, for 60 days. That's what I think your client testified to.
Well, but until that, if the insured accepts it, if Emmer's Camper's Corral had been able to accept that quote before the hailstorm, then yes, Erie would be on the risk. But Mr. Alderman is an agent of Erie Insurance and has a fiduciary obligation to notify Erie.
I thought he was a broker.
Oh no. Well,
he's not a broker.
He's an insurance agent of Erie.
Okay.
But for the Western Heritage, because it's with the excess and surplus lines market, then he does not have an agency agreement with Western Heritage. You go to the wholesale broker and then to Western Heritage.
So there's somebody in between.
There's an extra layer in there in the distribution. But the excess and surplus lines market is set up in the insurance marketplace for riskier risks, which what propelled Emmer's Campers Corral into the excess and surplus lines market.
Counsel, the Chief Justice had brought this up, I think, and I just wanted to maybe hear a direct answer to this question. Is Ms. Emmer's testimony about what she was told regarding the policy that would be available to her and that she would be getting, could the jury reasonably rely on that? And if not, why not?
Well, I think that it's sufficient to it's sufficient evidence to establish whether or not there was a negligent misrepresentation made by Mr. Alderman, which, as the court recognizes, we deny that it was stated. But that's sufficient to establish whether or not a negligent misrepresentation was made to Rhonda Emmer. But it doesn't establish anything other than that. Unless I'm not understanding the court's question.
Well, I guess I'm just pondering whether that's evidence from which a jury could find that she could have gotten a policy because she was, according to herself, she was told I could have gotten the policy. I could have gotten such a policy, and in fact, I was offered such a policy. And
because Mr. Alderman said it's available.
In her recounting. Correct.
In her recounting.
Right.
I don't think that's sufficient evidence of what's available in the insurance marketplace.
Because
it is simply speculation on it's a misunderstanding on her part and speculation, and indeed Mr. Alderman testified, no, you couldn't get it. And then we have evidence from Mr. Sutton that, no, it's not possible to get it.
Why isn't her testimony sufficient to show reasonable reliance? She relied on what he told her, and she was damaged because she had another hailstorm with a $5,000 deductible.
She relied on it, but not to her detriment.
Why wasn't it to her detriment? If she thought she had it, and if the jury believed her,
right,
that he told her that, why isn't that sufficient?
Because Emmer's Campers Corral could not have procured a policy with a $1,000 deductible in the insurance marketplace.
But you're going back into the other claim, which was negligent provision of the wrong policy. That's not what I was concerned about. I may not be making my point clear. Thank you.
My time is up. Are there any other questions?
No.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Well, based on your question, I assume that you did find that citation in my brief, at least, and I would note that, and this is with regarding the defense expert.
Right.
And that would be at 108, pages 142 and 1.
What about that two-year time period that counsel referenced? I mean, those are not within that two-year time period. Said I knew I had to wait 2 years before I could get that kind of policy.
You mean you're talking about Alderman's?
I thought counsel referenced that she said she knew she couldn't get that policy with those conditions for 2 years because of the claims that were made.
He was referencing the defense expert, who again was hired on the standard of negligence. That it would be impossible, his testimony that it would be impossible for her to get a $1,000 deductible during a policy period. And what I was pointing out was that was somewhat, qualified later in that deposition by the questioning, and Chief Justice was asking for the citation on that.
So do you have evidence that refutes that, so to create a genuine issue of fact?
Yeah, I mean, this is, the defense expert said that it's agreed that it's based on relationships, how much volume we have as a company. You go back 10 years prior, you look at loss information, you work with the underwriter, it's always different.
So that's what you're relying on for there to be a genuine issue of fact?
Well,
that's
really not what I'm relying on. I'm relying on the burden of production. That's what I'm relying on. I'm saying the burden of production was met, and then after that, it's a jury question.
Are you asserting then, just to tie it up, if I may, are you asserting that an error was made because there was a genuine issue of material fact in dispute?
Well, I would. There certainly is a material, an issue of material fact in dispute. And
what are you arguing? I mean, what's the petition for? You know, we gotta settle on something. I understood, but I'm wrong maybe, I understood that you were putting your eggs in the basket of burden of production, general availability. That constitutes causation, and that's where the legal error was, as opposed to that there is a genuine issue of material fact that should have gone to the jury.
Well, my argument, if we're getting into the summary judgment question, you know, my primary argument is that this could have been brought as a breach of contract.
I didn't think
you want to talk about that.
No, but it wasn't in the petition for review.
Right, okay.
The burden the way you would like it to be, do you still win?
If
she has to show that she could have this policy, she could have acquired this policy at this juncture, do you still win?
The question becomes, is there a reasonable inference? And I think it's a difficult one to make. I think the point being, could a reasonable inference been made based on the Erie policy? And you know, that was offered at the same time she thought she had a $1,000 deductible under the Western policy. Is that enough for a jury to make an inference? I think it is.
Well, really the question is it clearly wrong for the trial court there? Because we're reading the cold words on a page, right? That's why the standard review is interesting here, that even if maybe it might pick it up fresh and come to the same conclusion, what do we do with this standard review that says the trial court sitting through this needs to be clearly wrong in saying that no jury sitting through this trial could have come to those conclusions, even if we might look at it and say, maybe I could.
Well, I mean, for one thing, we're really not talking about credibility issues in terms of the damages issue. And so there's no dispute that Erie made offered her a contract for a $1,000 deductible during the same policy period of the Western. Now, that wasn't before that. It wouldn't have replaced it, but I think it's certainly evidence that we were this close. And I think it goes back to the whole question of, you know, what is the underwriting risk here, and how do different companies perhaps look at it, what is a reasonable inference here that a jury could have made? And also the issue of mitigation. I understand there's no direct evidence about what she would have done, but I think that
Well, thank you very much. Thank you both. This is a really interesting case, really interesting. I appreciate both of you bringing it to us, and I understand how that is to pick something up on appeal and not have the ability to do what you might have done if you were the trial attorney, but I think you both did a very good job. Thank you very much, and the briefs were helpful, too. We are now going to adjourn conference at... We are adjourned.